Every difficulty, I think, has a learning inside. I think we have to not complain or sit in that space, rather, you know, figure out what the learning is and kind of move into it, move through it, and not be afraid to look at it and deal with it, you know, because I think we can only move forward through that process. And, you know, don't be afraid to look at yourself. I think you'll find out a lot of things and you have to let go of certain things and embrace others. And it's okay.
Okay, today's guest on the Gravity Podcast is Judy Huang. As an immigrant from China, Judy's journey towards entrepreneurship and membership in the YPO organization has been marked by unconventional challenges. Growing up amidst familial difficulties, Judy cultivated resilience and adaptability, crucial traits that fueled her entrepreneurial endeavors. Navigating cultural transitions, she found strength in diversity, which coupled with early experiences formed the basis of her business approach, emphasizing perseverance and vision. Despite facing obstacles such as glaucoma, these trials enriched her business acumen and strengthened her Christian faith, ultimately shaping her into a successful entrepreneur with a story of overcoming adversity to inspire others towards resilience and determination. Well, welcome back to the Gravity Podcast. I'm here with Judy Huang. Judy, thanks for taking some time to join me on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited to learn more about you and to hear your story. We've connected, you know, at various YPO events, and I know that there's some overlap in our interests, and I know that you have a passion for this human experience that we're trying to share and normalize here on the podcast. So yeah, let's start at the beginning. I want to hear your kind of early childhood, and I know there's a lot there, you know, that leads you to what you're doing today, but let's start right at the beginning.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate you inviting me. I really appreciate listening to a lot of your podcasts and a lot of your guests and your own personal stories. And so I appreciate you inviting me here. And hopefully a little bit of my story is interesting to others as well. So yeah, let's just start with the background. Born in mainland China back in the early 70s. And it was during the time then Nixon visited China. And at the time, China is pretty close to the outside country, outside world, I should say. So we had a premier or a leader called Mao Zedong, and he is a very totalitarian leader. Had a lot of cultural revolutions, people that were born in different, let's say, professions in their life, from engineers or teachers or people that are landowners or bourgeois classes, were really shunned and often put in jail. And that's kind of what happened with both of my parents, come from the bourgeois class. And because of that, they had really a difficult childhood. And my mom's father were put in jail and he passed away. So my grandfather passed away when he was in his 40s and my mom was only 13 at the time. And she had a family of six. So they really had an overhaul. And that's kind of the background. And I grew up with that kind of background as well. Obviously, with both parents being part of that bourgeois class and the Cultural Revolution. So, and then I immigrated to the United States at the age of 12 myself.
Before you tell me about that, I'm just curious if you could maybe elaborate when you say that you grew up with that, you know, to the age of 12. Certainly, I think, you know, that's old enough to really have, you know, memories and an embodied experience of what that was like. Mm-hmm. Can you just, you know, maybe say a little bit more of what you remember from that time?
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, I don't know whether I experienced it exactly in the United States, but at the time, my parents, because of their bourgeois class, had to report to the local police bureau often to see, you know, whether they have any spies activities. And I remember as a kid, police people often visiting our apartment. And then also my uncles were not around very often because they were also in jail because they spoke out against the country. And then my father actually left at the age of 5 and swam across Guangzhou to Hong Kong. And so I did not have my father. starting at age 5. And so even at the age of 12 and under, I knew that a lot of turmoil was happening within the home. Mm-hmm. And I really only had my mom as a single parent growing up. And in schools, I did pretty good. I was a pretty compliant kid. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't feel it as much at school, but I definitely felt it within the neighborhood that I lived in, and also the trips that my mom had to make to the police bureau.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine, you know, it's unsettling, scary. I don't know. Did it become just the norm for you? I mean, you know, how much was that, you know, impacting just your life outside of school, at least?
Yeah, I guess my mom did a pretty good job of, you know, allowing me to prosper, allowing me to grow up on my own. Mm-hmm. She, you know, did a lot of, like, we didn't have hot water at our own home. And that's pretty common back in those days. So I had to go often down the street with a thermos to get hot water. So I think I was 8 or 9. And she allowed me to do that kind of stuff. We actually didn't have a running toilet in our own home. So we had to have a potty thing and we had to dispose of it in the morning. Mm-hmm. And again, that's the stuff that I had to do. But I don't know. I think my mom did a good job. She was my best friend. Mm-hmm. And even though we had our differences now as an adult, but I think she provided a lot of love and a lot of autonomy and independence early on for me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell me, 12 years old, mm-hmm. you immigrate. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah. So for the first time, I remember seeing my father again, because mm-hmm. I haven't seen him. And then we first went to San Francisco, which is where my mom's siblings are. So my aunt and my uncle, and they are already pretty successful in San Francisco in the real estate space, similar like yourself. And because my uncle and aunt came to the United States probably much earlier than we did. We immigrated in the early 80s or late 70s.
I'm just curious. I'm sorry. This is maybe like, I don't know, an important question, but it's a curiosity of mine. Mm-hmm. When you're told at 12 that we're going to San Francisco, is there like a lot of buildup to that? Is it like, we're going tomorrow? You know, how did you actually come over? You know, how civilized was that experience?
Well, I mean, along the way, I knew that we wanted to leave the country of China because of all the difficulties that we've been put under. So mom, all along the way, have said to me that we're going to leave and that's the goal. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a buildup, and she's the last sibling of her team, of her family to leave China. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of anticipation. I remember when I left, I got a perm. You know, I was 12 and I got a perm, and it was a big deal. And we went to Hong Kong first.
It was the 80s.
Yeah, it was the 80s. And so we went to Hong Kong first. Uh-huh. And I remember leaving the airplane. I felt, wow, like landing in Hong Kong, I felt, wow, the air even smells like sweet and different. And then we went from Hong Kong, then landed there for like a short time, and then flew to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So you end up, you get to San Francisco and you've got family there, and yep. your family's already, you know, found their way. Mm-hmm. So that's got to be super helpful to integrate into that, right?
Yeah, I think that would be a good assumption, except I think the siblings, my mom's siblings, had a lot of outlook on money that's very like, you know, you've been poor and now you have money. And the way to look at the money is it's very monopolizing. Mm. And so it wasn't a very collaborative relationship. And same for my cousins. And I would say mostly that's true for my aunt, my oldest aunt or my mom's oldest sister. And she was kind of the matriarch of the family. So it was actually pretty hard because there was a lot of groveling that we had to do because we're the new newbies. And mm-hmm. and then I was, you know, didn't speak very good English, right? So my cousins picked on me and I went to school for a short time there and had a hard time. And so my father, on the other hand, immigrated to Boston as a refugee. So he swam across the ocean from Guangzhou to Hong Kong. And then he's a mechanical engineer. He worked in Hong Kong. And then he came to the United States as a refugee. And so his landing place was in Boston. So after probably 6 months to 9 months of difficulty with my aunt, we decided to move to Boston with my dad. And, you know, and I guess my memories of that was more clear through the pictures that we took than my own memory. And at first I was very happy because, you know, we were together as a family again. But I think my mom and my dad got married, not really because of love, because of the fact that they were both from the bourgeois class in China and really needed each other in order to survive. And so now that they're in the United States, they don't have that difficulty anymore of needing each other. And so the relationship quickly fell apart. And I remember as a kid, only child, you know, why is this happening? Or, you know, is this my fault? Or all those typical questions. And unfortunately, my parents also did not have a good separation. So the separation was not good. And so I definitely felt the divorce.
Mm-hmm. And you were, what, 13, 14 years old now? Or
right, yeah. 13, 14, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. You know, my sister was 13 when my parents got divorced. And yeah, it's hard. It's a, you know, it's hard on, I think, kids in general, especially then. You know, I think maybe now today, I think divorce has sort of been normalized and done better. Mm-hmm. But I think in the 80s, you know, it was still very common for it to be messy and advantageous. And, you know, just if you're a teenager and you're in that experience, it's tough, really, mm-hmm. really very hard, mm-hmm. traumatic.
I think the divorce is hard, but also I think coming to a new country as a now 13, 14, coming into teenagehood.
Yeah.
You know, as an adult looking back and then not really speaking the language, right? And then, oh my gosh, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, the combination of factors is really a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel that, you know, mm-hmm. and I get that, you know,
and
from you.
And you also come from a divorce.
Yeah. And but you're right. I mean, not speaking the language and being in a foreign country and having to, you know, make a new life. I mean, we moved from Akron, Ohio to Columbus, Ohio. It was difficult,
right?
You know, finding new friends and fitting in and those mm-hmm. kinds of things as a teenager. But when you're moving, you know, across the globe and learning new language and new culture, and, you know, that's a lot for a teenage girl. It's a lot for anybody.
But I think I feel like God's presence was already, you know, there even during that time. Mm-hmm. I had a really good friend. Her name is Danielle. And we unfortunately haven't stayed in touch, but she made a big difference in my life. I had really great teachers that helped me with, you know, puberty because mm-hmm. my mom was gone. And so just to finish up for the divorce, I ended up staying with my father because he was financially more stable than my mom. And so my mom moved back to San Francisco. And so I really had beautiful people in my life, even during that time to help me along.
Yeah, boy. I like the way you phrased that, you know, God's presence, because I mean, that's, you know, what I would call it too, mm-hmm. you know, and yet, you know, I don't know what your beliefs were at that time. You know, did you have a faith at that time, or did you notice, you know, these kinds of things, or was it, you know, in hindsight, you look back and you see, boy, that was, you know, a blessing.
Yeah, it's definitely in hindsight. China is really not a faith-based country. So especially during that time. But, you know, really along the way, as I look back, there's a lot of, you know, God's touches there. So, but at the time, you know, I was just really thankful for these people that came into my life. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that along my life as we go through my journey.
Mm-hmm. And what were you interested in? I mean, did you start to kind of, in hindsight, you know, can you see how your personality or your interest started to develop that maybe connects to how you move forward in your life?
Probably not at age 13, 14. You know, I was trying to fit in. I moved to a school that had ESL, so English as a second language. So in Boston, we were bused to school. I also lived pretty poorly, I guess, or pretty in low income level. So we went to school in Charlestown. For people that are from Boston, maybe you know that area. That's a pretty bad area during that time. And I went back to visit the school actually several years ago, and it had, you know, I didn't realize how poor of a neighborhood it was or how small of a school it was. But at the time it was great because I had teachers that were ESL teachers, and But to answer your question, I don't think I came into myself, but I think I definitely gained confidence more and more because my English started to improve. You know, a lot of people here in Columbus says my English is pretty good. And, you know, I guess I was lucky enough to come to the country under the age of 13. I think you lose your accent that way. Mm-hmm. But obviously there's a lot of American-born Chinese. So I started to gain more and more of my, you know, language ability. Mm-hmm. And coming into myself, I wouldn't say I came into myself until probably when I did a semester abroad in Hong Kong in my college years. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was lucky enough to get a full scholarship to go to Boston College. And then junior year, I went to Hong Kong. And that's really when I feel that I saw the connection going on in terms of what my possibility could be.
Mm. And I'm just curious, before we jump to that, I want to hear more about that connection. But I am curious to hear more about your relationship with your parents. Mm-hmm. As you know, your mom moves to San Francisco. I'm just thinking about like that time, you know, we didn't have FaceTime, text messaging, you know, the communication options were more limited. I don't know exactly, you know, how your relationship was with your mother at that time. So maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on, you know, how things unfolded with your parents, you know, between that, you know, 13 to, you know, college age.
Yeah, good question, Brad. You're always great at really reading and looking at deeper questions. So I appreciate that. Actually, you know, as I said, my mom did a good job under the age of 12. But I think since then she moved to the United States, she really needed to get herself into making good income and surviving, I guess. And so when she left, I felt, you know, a big void because she was my best friend. And so I didn't have that. We wrote letters back to each other. We called each other. And then I think my father was very strict. He was an engineer. So he had to park his car. He had a Chevy Nova, and he had to park his car a certain way. It had to be lined up a certain way. And he used to write letters and had to be, you know, the envelope had to be, you know, straight. Mm-hmm. And so my dad, you know, was a very strict dad. And I think I was on a phone call with a boy, I think, I don't know, 15, 16, and he didn't like that. So he made me write a letter, you know, writing, saying, you know, I will always think about where the sources of my love comes from, you know. So I think he really meant well, but he, I think, took it a little too strict. I mean, I have a 17-year-old now, almost 18. So, you know, I think parenting is how you work with your child, you know? And so I think his approach was a little hard at the time. Mm-hmm. And then with my mom, so with my dad, I didn't really have that friendship relationship like I had with my mom. But looking back as an adult, my mom was more of a friend than a parent, you know? So whereas my dad was more of a parent. Mm-hmm. And I probably needed more of the parent versus the friend. And so around sophomore year in high school, I decided I'm going to move to San Francisco with my mom because I didn't want to live with my dad because he was so strict and all that. So I went to San Francisco and I lived with my mom, and that was a very tough time. She was remarried at the time, and I was no longer kind of her friend because she was focused on her work and focused on her husband. And so she should, right? As an adult, I look back. But at the time, it was tough because, you know, I really wanted that friendship like we had before. And so my mom and I, since then, have always had ups and downs in our relationship. So to answer your question, that's what the relationship was like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you decide to go back to Boston for college. Tell me about that decision and this broad experience that you had.
Yeah. So, you know, my mom got remarried. She's now a real estate agent and she's done well with her husband. And so I was there for 2 years. And so I decided, you know, this is not the relationship that I should be in. So I talked to my dad, and dad said, come on back. So I went back to Boston in my senior year, and with good grades and low income, I got a full scholarship to Boston College. So it was really, I remember I was at a club, and actually the Boston College Club, and there's a bunch of people there talking about scholarships. And I went up to them. I said, you know, I'm one of the recipients of your scholarships. Mm. And I just want to say you really made a difference in my life. Mm. And so I have a small little scholarship at the Columbus Foundation. I really feel like, you know, I was given a great opportunity. So God's blessed me and I should do the same. That's so nice. Yeah. So I've done that. But so then I got a full scholarship to Boston College. And then in junior year, I decided to go to Asia. I think the whole class at BC, nobody went to Asia. I was the only one that went to Asia. So went to Hong Kong, did a semester abroad, had a great time, did a summer internship as well, working for the American Chamber of Commerce, selling ads for one of their books. And I decided I should really come back because I spoke the language. I had a different, you know, I have a different asset. I had a different differentiation, you know. And when I graduated, there wasn't a lot of, I graduated in 92. The U.S. economy wasn't that great. And so I decided to, when I graduated, sent, I think, 125 resumes out and I got one reply. And that company hired me to go back to Beijing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so after college, I went back to Beijing to work in the real estate field.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about that. What was calling you there? What was exciting to you about that?
About Beijing?
Well, Beijing and real estate, or, you know, just, you know, why did you make that decision?
Well, like I said, I did the semester abroad and it was really where my differentiation was, you know, spoke the language and China was growing. And this is shortly after Tiananmen Square. So there's a lot more opportunities there than in the US at the time. So I did.
Mm-hmm. And how was that experience? Was that a good one? Or tell me about, you know, kind of what happens next.
Sure. It was good at first. I was the typical kind of kid out of college, have a very idealistic of the world. Mm-hmm. So I felt, you know, if I did well at my job, I didn't have to kiss butt and I could just, you know, be fine. And I think that's very common for a newly grad. And so I did good. I was in the sales and marketing for a real estate property that was close to the airport in Beijing. And so did well. But again, I didn't know the politics of things, politics of the company. So I was actually fired then from my job. And that was, I think, a year into the job. And they fired me pretty disgruntledly. I was very disgruntled about it. They didn't do a good job of how they, I guess, fired me. Mm-hmm. And
why did they fire you?
Like I said, I don't think I played politics very well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because of the results of my sale, because mm-hmm. I was in sales and marketing. I did a great job.
Mm-hmm. Meaning like you weren't like kissing enough butt or like what?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's it.
Uh-huh.
It was a Hong Kong-based real estate company. It's very political, and mm-hmm. you had to kiss the right ass. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. This is, again, back in the 90s, right? And mm-hmm. there's not a lot of, and you're in Asia, and you're in Hong Kong, and mm-hmm. that's, I guess that's how it was for this particular company.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then I went out, and I competed against them, mm-hmm. and I started my own real estate company. And then it was successful, because I knew a lot of the owners of this real estate project, and I expanded beyond other real estate projects. So I started a company kind of like an HER mm-hmm. agency. And I met people like yourself or the developers or the individual owners of the apartments. And I did a lot of the leasing and sales for expats that are living in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think I made $60,000 for the first 3 months. And I was 22 at the time. So it was really, it was exhilarating at the mm-hmm. time. And also coming from, you know, no money as a child, as a person. Mm-hmm. So again, I felt very, very kind of like on a high, you know. And I made a lot of mistakes. Like I was not nice to one of my staff and I opened her mail. Mm-hmm. And we had a fist fight in Beijing, on the streets of Beijing. So that was not a smart move.
Uh-oh.
So yeah, I learned a lot of mistakes during that time.
You don't seem like a fist fighter to me, but this is a different time.
Different time.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Different time. So no, I've learned a lot during that time.
I bet.
Good and bad things. Yeah.
Well, I actually, you know, it's funny. I was with a friend of mine the other day. He was talking about having to make payroll on his credit card, you know, back in the early 2000s and calling, you know, the 1-800 number to get the limit moved up just so he could make the payroll. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, in the entrepreneurial world don't talk about those kinds of things, mm-hmm. you know, that you get fired or, you know, you end up in a fist fight with a colleague. I mean, you know, you open someone's mail. I mean, we do things. In fact, I actually ran into somebody earlier in the week at a Cavaliers basketball game that I used to do business with. And I was just thinking back, it's, you know, been a decade. I hadn't seen the guy in 10 years. And was thinking back to like some of the arguments that we got in and probably some of the ways that I opened my mouth and yelled out of, you know, anger, you know, at each other, because, you know, I was at a different spot in my life and I didn't know how to control those emotions, or I was afraid that it wasn't going to work, or I maybe, you know, even, I don't know, thought I knew better or something. And it's all real and true and mm-hmm. part of what happened, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not as uncommon when you're in this either stage in life or you're feeling pressures of, you know, trying to be successful, make money, you know, get a business to work, whatever it might be. It happens. Mm-hmm. People don't really want to talk about it because they're ashamed or it's, you know, sort of frowned upon. But I like just how open you were about sharing those things. It's very normal. You know, we just don't talk about it that much.
Yeah, I think I've always been pretty, you know, along the way, I've gotten into meditation. I know that's one of the connections that we have, and just a lot more self-awareness about myself. And I think it is important to be authentic and to be real, because I think it's freeing, you know, first of all, and it's hopefully better understanding and better in terms of improvements, maybe, or in terms of just, I think it's a lot easier to be authentic than to hide something. And then you got to figure out what you hide, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I do find those stories of successful people where they started with $5 and then now they're $50 million. So what happened along the way, mm-hmm. like you said? So mm-hmm. yeah, there's a lot of bumps along the way for at least my journey. And I presume for most people, I think you learn through your mistakes, right? You don't learn a lot through your success times.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, hopefully you do. You know, that's the thing, mm-hmm. right? And it's not like a guarantee that you can look back and say, you know, I've changed, right? You have to actually do that work. Mm. And I'm curious about kind of the work that you've done. I don't want to shortcut anything yeah. else that's important in that journey, you know, between those that time to whatever is most important next. But I am curious, you know, you talked about meditation, you talked about, you know, doing this work, becoming, you know, more aware, self-aware, just kind of curious to hear how that comes into your life.
Yeah. I mean, like you often use the word curious, right? I think curiosity is really huge in this journey. So, you know, I was blessed again with the business. And then I met my husband in China and then we both moved back to Columbus. He's from Columbus. And along the way, I've developed this eye condition called glaucoma. And it's a eye condition where, you know, if it's not managed well, you know, you could lose your sight. So there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of loss of control. There's a lot of loss of sight, which is, I think, a very scary thing. Mm. And along the way, when I moved back to the States, I realized that I had a lot of financial success, but I wasn't a very happy person. Mm-hmm. And we got much more involved in our church, in the church that we belong to now. It's called Dwell. It used to be called Xenos, and it's a Christian-based church. And to me, there was then a better understanding of how things connected to each other from the people that were in my life that I said earlier mm-hmm. that touched me. Things that, you know, you couldn't explain because it is faith, mm-hmm. you know? And also, I wanted to not be so anxious. And so I developed the meditation practice. I took a class at Ohio Health. It's based on Jon Kabat-Zinn. Mm-hmm. And then John and I also took the class together. And I belong to a Sangha group right now, which is a group of people that meditate together. And we share kind of with each other our lives. And it is a practice. It is a daily work. Mm-hmm. It is a often, you know, minute by minute work. Like I'm sitting here, I could feel whether I'm tense or tight or, mm-hmm. and I can try to breathe into that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of either Jon Kabat-Zinn's material or other materials that really has given me a lot of insights. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of then bringing these insights out when you're in the midst of you know, complexity or turmoil or difficulties.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it to be, you know, and I'm kind of wanting to hear more about that because I think it'd be helpful for you to clarify how you use your practice in your life. Mm-hmm. Because I think sometimes people don't understand how it becomes embodied in who you are so that you have access to it. And it's not like a, oh, I'm going to go to my, into my pocket or on my phone and pull out this tool and read something to remind me of how to be, mm-hmm. right? It's more of a practice of that becoming, you know, who you are. And even when you lose it, you know, it's there and it sort of finds its way back. That's been my experience, but maybe you could elaborate a little bit on, you know, how it goes for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the many experiences I've experienced, you know, from being an entrepreneur and then moving here, also being an entrepreneur, and, you know, I made lots of mistakes along the way here as well. You know, you face things and you search for things. And so, you know, my faith has really taught me a lot about, you know, we're not in control. And same with meditation has taught me that. And so for me, the practice is I try to do a regular practice. So that's pretty important.
Regular being
like ideally once a day, mm-hmm. at least, you know, 10, 15 minutes mm-hmm. on the cushion or, you know, Tuesday nights we have our Sangha group or Thursday nights we have our church group. So I think the community and the regularity of the practice, and then I've been blessed that I pick it up pretty quick. I really sense it. I feel it. And mm-hmm. I can really, you know, channel my breath in the way that maybe it's a six direction breath or maybe it's a breath coming in from the head. And I'm pretty good at feeling then what I'm feeling right now. So that's a practice, regular practice, and journaling. Mm-hmm. Putting down on paper some of the epiphanies that come to us, maybe when we have silence, when we have breath, when then, you know, God speaks to us, then I jot that down. Mm-hmm. Like one recently is, you know, I'm 53 this year and I just realized that, you know, I might not have as much time, certainly not as much time in the next phase of my life. And I really want to make a difference. So I think, you know, stuff like that, I think you have to really hear those thoughts mm-hmm. and you really have to internalize them and really not let the busyness of the day take that over.
Mm, yeah. Boy, is that true. I think that is one of the benefits of kind of three things that you've touched on, which, you know, I'm feeling as well, you know, at this stage in life. But the meditation certainly, I think, moves energy out that allows you to kind of be more aware and kind of see life in that way. And your life experience up until this point, you know, really does shape you, hopefully, and maybe those two things really go hand in hand, that you then can kind of see how you've landed in this place. And then just the age itself, I think, sort of forces you, especially as you see things happen around you mm-hmm. or to you, right? Your experience with glaucoma, or if you've had, you know, friends that experience tragedy or have any loss in your own life, you start to really be forced to look at, you know, the period of time that remains, whatever that is, and what you want to do with it. Now, I think it's, I don't know, like the percentages, but you know, it seems like most people don't want to look at any of those things and it's too hard. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you know, even in my own life, I can say sometimes it's easier to be busy. You know, it's easier to not stop and, you know, look in the mirror and ask tough questions. Mm. So I want to hear more about, you know, kind of now that you've landed in this place, you know, with these tools, this faith, these practices, this experience in life, you know, now what? Tell me more about kind of where you are now and, you know, what you're focused on today.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, with these realization, for example, my age, I can't change that. And what I've already understand, I can't change that. And every day that you live, let's say in the busyness and you ignore the messages, it's going to come at you again tomorrow, you know? And so if we want to be wise about our time and our experience and be in the present moment, then we have to really consciously live there. And I could say that right now sitting here because I am in the present moment, but you know, get me right in the middle of work, I don't think I'm often there. And that's really what I would love to practice more. I'm blessed to have a great business. We work with Asia and contract manufacturing. I have a great team, but I lose my cool, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes. And I think I'm caught in that emotion rush and I'm not, you know, mindful. And even though I do these practices, so there's no like guilt or blame for myself, but it's just an acknowledgement, and mm-hmm. that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And you know, to continue to practice and have others who support you in that journey, you know, like other fellow believers or practitioners. And so I'm thankful that, you know, one, I have a small little scholarship fund. I get to interview kids that are interested in applying, and they're similar. They are early immigrants from a difficult childhood, difficult income level. And I get to make a little difference. You know, my business, I hope one day to make it an employee-owned business. I don't look at it as like I need to exit with a private equity and get lots of return. I don't think that's the legacy I want to leave behind. I want to leave behind where I want to make a difference in people's lives. And, you know, my daughter, who's 17, Faith is her name. She's adopted from Wuhan. And you know, we are going through the learning journey of ADHD together as a family. And, you know, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's okay.
So she's growing up and she's maturing. And so I feel really good as being a mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about that. I know it's emotional, you know, and that could be a lot of things. You know, I don't want to assume or project. So tell me about that experience.
Yeah. So my daughter's 17. We just went to a driving school last night. She's learning how to drive. And yeah, so she's goes to school at Tree of Life. We have a spring break coming up. We're going to look at some colleges. She's thinking about going to forensics. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I think being a parent, you learn a lot about yourself. Mm. I was definitely not the most patient parent, and I was not the most easygoing parent. I had pretty high expectations. But ultimately, I want to have a relationship with my daughter. That's really my ultimate aim, you know, wherever that leads to. And we're in a really cool space because she's so smart and we have really cool conversations about big things, you know? And this ADHD discovery, we started reading the book of Driven to Distraction as a family together. And there's just so much understanding about these acronyms and what it encompasses, what it does to that person, and how does people around the ADHD person react, and what we should do, and how do we coach her. And so it's really been cool for us to go through that journey together.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you know, I've learned in my own parenting journey that I think a lot of times we're unconscious to how we're parenting because it's just, you know, we're pulling from what we experienced, whether we know it or not even, you know, usually we don't even know it. And that could be good or bad. You know, I had examples of both. And so it wasn't all bad, but there was parts that, you know, I took on that I was unconscious to. It's just all I knew. It's just who I was because of how I was raised. And yet, when you do start to become aware of how you're being, especially as a parent, you know, there is an opportunity to change too. And I had Norman Shubb, the old kind of Columbus.
Yep, I remember Norman.
You know,
had a ponytail, right?
Yes, yeah. He was the YPO therapist.
Yeah.
But he was amazing and I loved him dearly. And he once told me, you know, it doesn't matter so much what happened. It matters with your kids. It matters more that they see you change because they'll remember that, you know, and they'll see that that's possible for them too, as they get into their own journeys. And, you know, you can create the relationship to be whatever you want. And there is a fine line, you know, this, you mentioned, you know, being a parent or a friend. I've probably been both
more the parent early, more the friend later. You know, it's a constant calibration. Mm. It's hard to be a parent to try to find that line. Mm. You know, am I being too soft, too tough? You know, am I patting on the back, not enough, too much? You know, it's tough. Mm. I mean, there's no, I remember our the OBGYN when our first was born, mm-hmm. you know, said, okay, I stamped the instructions on his back. Good luck.
Yeah.
You just don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing everything for the first time ever, yeah. all along the way. But, you know, I can see just in the emotion how much you care and probably, you know, how much you try and, you know, how much you probably continue to get better as you go. And that's all you can do.
Right, right. That's interesting what you said about what Norman said, that it's important for your child to see you change and mm-hmm. observe your change. And I mean, Faith is not here to say, but I don't know whether she would say that I've changed. Mm-hmm. I hope so. So, but it's a day-by-day practice, right? It's a day-by-day practice.
Absolutely.
And then you ask for forgiveness if something goes bad, right? Mm-hmm. From, you know, I didn't do very good today, Faith, sorry. Or I'm not feeling super good. Give me some time. Or,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I feel really blessed. I prayed for, you know, a child that is close to God, and I prayed for her and she came. Mm-hmm. We were actually in Israel at the time when we got her information at the Wailing Wall. So hence her name.
Wow. That's hard to ignore.
Yeah.
Faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, Judy, what else maybe should we land on? Anything else that you want to make sure that you share with the audience?
No, I think just the point of being persistent, you know, and the point of pushing through despite challenges that you were given, you know, whether it's your parents or whether it's the income or whether it's whatever. I think we shouldn't be hindered by those mm-hmm. things in the past. I think we should, you know, out of every difficulty, or like my glaucoma, every difficulty I think has a learning inside. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to not complain or sit in that space, rather, you know, figure out what the learning is and kind of move into it, move through it, and not be afraid to look at it and deal with it, mm-hmm. you know, because I think we can only move forward through that process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't be afraid to look at yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you'll find out a lot of things, and you have to let go of certain things and embrace others. Mm. And it's okay, you know? Yeah. No one's perfect. Only God is perfect. So don't give yourself a hard time. Mm. And just also very grateful for all the, from the lessons to the people to the circumstances I've been in. Mm. So I would just end with that.
Mm. Wise words. And yeah, I'll just say, you know, in the times we've, you know, run into each other and, you know, been able to connect, you know, I think you do a wonderful job of really sharing yourself and sharing, you know, your interests and your passions and connecting with people. Mm. And I appreciate you sharing, you know, kind of vulnerably today, you know, where it is that you're still a work in progress, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, I think we all are. And it's really important to say it out loud and let other people know that it's okay. Mm. And I think it's part of the process of shifting and integrating and improving is to, you know, acknowledge these things, bring them out of the dark and into the light. Mm. And that's part of the healing process. It's part of the, you know, self-improvement process. Mm. And it is very connected to others, you know, and ultimately to God. Mm. So thank you, Judy. Thank you for coming today and for sharing your story.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, for just being in this community. You know, you're an important part of it.
Yeah, thank you for asking some of the really thoughtful, curious questions, because it really makes me think of those times and, mm-hmm. yeah, discover myself a little bit more. So I appreciate that.
Good. All right. Thanks. That's a wrap.
Thank you for listening to the Gravity Podcast. Please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the entire Gravity Project, please go to gravityproject.com. Please check out the podcast on Instagram at The Gravity Podcast. Music heard of the show is provided courtesy of Kyle Lamoro and Oliver Oak.